Mr. Conlon.
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. The issue of substantial interest is one that is not often litigated. I don't believe it's ever been litigated in Guam. This is the first time that any government entity has tried to declare a substantial interest of the government. As indicated in my previous argument in the earlier motion, we were able to determine that apparently 18 jurisdictions have adopted the Uniform Procurement Act or Code in some form or another. And of those 18 jurisdictions, we only found one case out of Hawaii which addressed the substantial interest of the government in those decisions and found that the closure of the public library system was not a substantial interest in face of procurement violations. And they talked about termination of employees and the loss of the use of the library systems, and they found that that just didn't meet the substantial interest test. Interestingly, in federal jurisprudence, in very similar situations, there is a fair amount of jurisprudence on substantial interest. In the federal system, they say that whether or not it is the best interest of the United States or urgent and compelling circumstances that significantly affect the interest of the United States are necessary to override the automatic stay that is put in place. And in the federal jurisdictions, they talk about the fact that the automatic stay provision is the keystone to ensure that the various provisions of the Procurement Act work to promote competitive contracting. The federal system requires four criteria to be met, and they are found in Riley's Wholesale Produce 73 claims at 705. They're also quoted in Superior Helicopters LLC at 78 federal claims, 181. They say that whether significant adverse consequences would occur if the agency did not override the stay. Two, whether reasonable alternatives are available to the override. Three, how the benefit of overriding the stay compared to the potential cost of the override, including the cost associated with the potential that the protester might prevail. And four, the importance of the competitive and the integrity of the competition and the procurement system. Now, those are the four requirements in order to override the best interest of the United States. And we're told that in the proceedings here, and there were a list of substantial interest declarations filed with the this body with regard to those matters, and Mr. Abrams has alluded to them in his opening, that there may be more expensive to build this project. A $50 million school that is going to cost the government over $150 million to build and operate for 30 years. The students and taxpayers deserve better than that, giving a $100 million profit to a contractor. The cost-effective schedule, it'll be more expensive in the future. Pure speculation. The children are suffering because they have to go to the Tejin campus. The children were suffering at the JFK campus. It was declared unsafe and had to be shut down by the government. The government talks about the students having a right to this location and this facility, and there is no such right. Clearly, what has occurred at JFK is a failure of the government. It's been a failure for many years. That doesn't mean that there is a substantial interest in the government to set aside the procurement process and the protests and merely award this because in 9 months, in the 2010 year, they want to have a facility, which may or may not be completed by that period of time, to move into Tamunin. And because we're told, and we're told, that in the earlier motion, we don't know if IBC will be granted an award, and we're that far away from an award, we can't pick a winner. But they're asking you to pick a winner today, when they can't pick one. They're asking you to say that they can award this to IBC when they told us earlier they're not prepared to do so. That's what the substantial interest is, to grant the contract, to grant the award. And it is certainly not in the best interest of procurement within this community to simply override the protest and grant an award at this time. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Abrams, the next thing is the purchasing agency's presentation of evidence. You may proceed with your first witness.
So my first witness would be the director, Mr. Paris.
Mr. Paris, would you please take the witness stand? Yes. Please remain standing to be sworn in.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony or affirmation that you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Please have a seat. And Mr. Perez, I just briefly admonish you to please speak into the microphone and speak. Okay, you may proceed, Mr. Perez.
Good morning, Mr. Perez. Would you please state your full name for the record and your position in government?
Yeah. Lawrence P. Perez, Director of the Department of Public Works.
And do you have any connection in the scope of your official duties with the procurement RFP for the rebuild of JFK High School?
Yes, I am the procurement officer for the JFK RFP.
And after protests were filed, after the GCIF protest was filed, has that procurement process proceeded?
No, we issued a stay of procurement immediately thereafter.
Should it be allowed to proceed? Should the procurement procedure be allowed to go forward?
Well, per the GCA, whenever there's a protest filed, the procedure is that we issue a stay of procurement and then ascertain the merits of the protest itself, at which time we issued a notice of decision that found no merit to the protesting, and we are now here before the appeals process.
Did you also issue a determination of substantial interest and allow the procurement to proceed to go ahead?
Yes, we did, and we did so for a myriad of reasons, which I've outlined in my write-up.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the date of that determination of substantial interest is on or about October 14th, 2009. Would that be correct?
October 14th, no, I'm sorry. We're not there yet.
No, August 14th.
I don't have the document from me, but it's about, as best I can recall, yes.
Okay, what were the reasons that you can explain to Mr. Camacho that gave rise to your determination of substantial interest in this procurement matter?
Many. if you look at the history of what the JFK students were faced with, there was an initial shutdown of the JFK school by the Attorney General's office for a myriad of violations, health, safety, and structural violations. So with the closure of that school, an emergency declaration was made to go into double sessions over at the GW High School. And in parallel, the legislature passed a statute, Public Law 29114, that mandated for the construct of a permanent facility for the JFK students. In that statute, it clearly mandated that the school be constructed within a 9-month window. And it authorized the Department of Public Works to work with the Guam Economic Development Authority to develop a request for proposal within a prescribed, I believe, 90-day time frame, whereby it can get a contractor to finance, design, build, and maintain this facility. So that process took on, or at least the DPW carried out the mandates of that law, and in parallel, the JFK students were relocated to GW High School on double session, and in parallel, the administration was working on a interim solution because it recognized that the GW double session had much to be desired. It placed the students in a compromising and an inadequate environment. So therein lies the third parallel track, where the government proceeded with a invitation to bid for lease of facilities for the temporary JFK students. So there was a situation where three parallel activities had to occur to address that urgency for getting the kids into a better school environment for its adequate education objective. So at this juncture, we are at a point where the kids are in the interim JFK location, but it's only been authorized for a 1-year window. Any further authorizations or use of the temporary JFK facility is pretty much at the purview of the legislature to authorize that activity as well as to fund it. So therein lies a situation where we have more of a compelling reason to move the procurement for the permanent JFK facility more so now than ever, knowing full well that there may or may not be authorization of funding for the temporary JFK. So we have a compelling reason to comply with the statute, Public Law 29114, to build the school as soon as is possible, and such that it's ready for the eventual expiration of the temporary JFK facility. That's one. The second is the facility that we're constructing, the permanent JFK facility, has all the amenities required by law regarding the environment and the key, as well as the structures necessary for a holistic school, high school type environment. This includes cafeterias, libraries, gymnasiums, classrooms, air conditioning, and everything all in compliance to the latest building codes, the International Building Code 2009 series. So what we're doing right now is we are aggressively, at least in the negotiations, we are aggressively negotiating the requirements that are outlined by law and are outlined by the building code to be done so in a 9-month window, such that it'll be ready for the opening of the next school year. So those are the two reasons why we think it's a substantial interest to the authority, to the territory.
What about building costs, Mr. Peters? Maybe you heard Mr. Friendly characterize my prediction that building costs would go up as conjecture. Is it conjecture, or do you have evidence that the longer this is delayed, the more building material costs is going to rise?
Well, actually, we have a myriad of tenders out there, and what we're noticing is an increase in goods, most importantly because most of these goods are actually imported. So yes, most definitely, because of the limited resources out there for labor, as well as the material costs that have to be imported, especially for these type activities, vertical activities, we're seeing an escalation in price for all these goods and services.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Ferris. If the Office of Public Accountability confirms your determination of substantial interest, there'll be no impediment to the bid procurement procedure going forward. Would that be correct?
That's correct.
And what would be the next step in that procurement procedure, Mr. Ferris?
The next step is to resume the last component of our overall negotiation, and that is for the contractor to go out and seek the financing and deliver that to the government.
And it remains to be seen how successful IBC will be in performing that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And if IBC were not successful, would it be correct to say that the number two bidder would then have a chance to develop that part of the obligation?
That is actually outlined in our request for proposal tender. That is a procedure for all RFPs that we conduct at DPW, and yes, most definitely. If the IBC fails to obtain the necessary financing, which is the last component. Mind you, there were at least four main components. If they fail to get the financing for this, we will issue them a cancellation, a termination of the negotiations, and issue a letter of intent to commence negotiations with a second ranked firm.
So, what I'd like to elicit from you now, as best you can define it for Mr. Camacho and the public auditor, would be a best case and a worst case scenario. Best case scenario, your determination is confirmed by OPA. IBC is successful in securing the financing. Documents are signed, an award is made, maybe in the reverse order. What kind of time frame is the best case scenario if IBC is successful in securing the financing within the allotted time? How quickly could the award be made? Just give us your best estimate on it.
No. Well, because a lot of the activities have been ongoing in collaboration with various, there's actual selection committee that have subject matter experts involved. We feel confident that once they secure the funding, we'll be able to execute all the component documents, including the ground lease agreement, the collateral equipment, the construction project, as well as the maintenance agreement. That attached to the financing, we anticipate appearances from the Guam Public School System Superintendent, the Attorney General's Office, and the Governor's Office to be completed within a 30-day work-toward time frame, at which time NTP will be issued, and they have no more than 9 months to complete the construction.
That's if IBC were successful.
That's correct.
Completing the last step. Suppose they're unsuccessful. Let's call this the worst-case scenario. How long would it take then to make an award, would you estimate?
If IBM were unsuccessful, if IBC were unsuccessful, then we will have to start round zero the negotiations with company number two. and we would start negotiating the collateral equipment, the contract of the building, the maintenance agreement, the ground lease agreement, and then have them go about their way to secure the financing.
With bidder number two, what sort of time frame are we looking at there?
Just the iterations that we had to go through with the selection committee members and the subject matter experts. I venture to say that, especially this is the second go-around, we'll probably complete all the negotiations within 90 days. And then that would give us, I'm not sure how to pick them, but 90 days thereafter for negotiating with all the firms on all the different components of this tender.
And if it went, if bidder number two was not, bidder number two is GEFF, is that right?
Yes.
I don't get, I don't always have the...
acronym?
Yes. I didn't remember the acronym, but it's the whole name that I have trouble with. But if GEFF as the number two bidder and unable to secure the financing, you'd go to the number three bidder, wouldn't you?
That's correct.
And that's GCIF, right?
That's correct.
And would it be correct to estimate that there would be a 30-day window for GEFF to put financing in place, and if they didn't do that, you would go to the third bidder, and there'd be another 30-day window to try and put financing in place by the third bidder, and then if they were successful, there'd even be more time, maybe another 90 days to nail down the award and start construction. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Just wanted to give some parameters to the bid procurement procedure that remains to be done, and what will happen? We talked about just now what would happen if the OPA did confirm your determination of substantial interest, but on the other hand, what would happen if the OPA for some reason decided not to confirm the determination of substantial interest? What do you see happening there?
Well, I was at the last hearing, and this is the first time I've been to this hearing process, the appeals hearings process. And I noticed that there's dedicated hearings for a myriad of things. One is for, I guess, the confidentiality. Another one is for the substantial interest, and I'm not sure what else is going to come out of the pipe. But if you were to follow this process, again, no denigration on the entity, but the agency, but there's another appeals appellant out there that has made an issue, and we provided us, the requisite stay of procurement and the requisite notice of decision, and that has its own clock as well. So we see another delay just to hear that case. If the opponents are not satisfied, we recognize that they've actually stated publicly that they're going to take it to court if they don't get the answer they want. So I don't know what the court systems, their scheduling, and how long that takes, but we just see major delays.
What's the effect of all that?
We can't do any procurement. Everything just stops until there's actually a stay, an indefinite stay, until such time that there's a final decision as high as the Supreme Court. That's what we understand it to be. And
if this scenario were to transpire, would this make it more or less likely that the current bid procurement could proceed to a final conclusion, to an award?
Well, the current bid procurement has actually been stayed, and we can't go any further as mandated by law. We can't award this contract, so nothing will happen. This procurement actually just gets prolonged, and it may be in the interest of the government, depending on how long this is, to actually just cancel this procurement and start anew. But just starting anew again, it's a long, drawn-out process. Not to mention the funding mechanisms may have changed. as of recent.
I think I might have one more question. This, let's back to the first scenario where the OPA confirms the determination of substantial interest that your agency made. The bid procurement procedure runs its course to an award. Isn't there a procedure whereby a dissatisfied bidder could contest that in court? After an award is made to one of the three, there would certainly be an opportunity for the other two bidders, if they wanted to go to court about that. Isn't that correct?
Sure, I agree. They do have that opportunity.
That's all I have, Mr. Ferris. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Tang, your witness. Thank you, Ms. Tang. Mr. Cunnell, your witness.
Thank you, Mr. Quattro. Mr. Perez, as the position you hold at Public Works, are you always the chief procurement officer for government construction projects of this type?
I understand it to be that, yes.
And have you ever issued a request for determination of substantial interest of the territory before?
No.
And the substantial interest you indicated was because of the delay in the procurement in the construction deadline process. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
What is your belief that there's a substantial interest that this project be awarded at this time?
I'll just rehash if you want me to. First, there was a mandate issued by the legislature and the governor, which is Public Law 29114. Thank you. That required that we build the school within 9 months, and there's history behind why that bill came to fruition, which I elaborated. There was a closure of the school by the Attorney General's office, and there was a need to put the kids into GW High School, which created an overcrowding situation, and thus the law. And so the bill, which eventually became Public Law 29114, ensued. And that called for the finance design bill maintain off the JFK, permanent JFK school, within a 9-month time frame. In parallel to that, because of the school conditions at the GW, double sessions and overcrowding, the government decided to engage in a temporary invitation to bid, where it got a separate contractor to provide temporary facilities for the JFK students so that they can be relocated out of GW into this temporary facility so that they can have some semblance to normalcy, if you will, of a school. And in parallel, we were actually, the governor signed a myriad of executive orders to help transition the Guam public school system, to moving the kids and getting them prepped for the new school year. There's also an authorization for this temporary JFK for only 1 year, for school year 2009 to 2010, and there has not been an authorization for any year thereafter. So we have a crisis where, unless the legislature approves an extension for a year or more thereafter, the kids will be out of a school, or they'll have to go back into a double session crisis similar to what happened at GW-JFK. So we're now given more reason to move more aggressively on constructing the permanent JFK soonest and in time for the opening of the next school year, which is 2010-2011. That's one reason. The other is that the facilities that we're providing for the kids, for the permanent JFK, calls for a cafeteria, gymnasium, a library, of course, adequate classroom space for 2,300 students, and there's a myriad of other amenities to be constructed for providing, I forget the actual site, the public law, but the adequate education for the JFK students, and to do so in 9 months. So that is the second reason that we're asking for this substantial interest of the territory. The third has to do with the increase in construction costs, associated labor and materials that we're experiencing with DPW, with all its other tenders, that we're seeing an increase in prices, and we feel that if this procurement is delayed any further, we can expect to see those trends apply here, and that is there'll be an increase in cost in terms of importing, in terms of labor costs, most especially if it's delayed to when the military actually, we believe, is going to commence constructing their activities, and that's in the year 2010. So, with those three main reasons, those are the reasons why we're requesting for the public auditor's determination of substantial interest of the territory.
When the public law was passed, it had a time frame for DPW to issue the RFP?
That's correct.
And you didn't meet that time frame?
Yes, we did. We made the time frame for issuing the RFP within 90 days.
You actually issued it after the time frame of 30 days that the government said so in the legislation?
I don't have a statute. We were tracking that, and from what I understand, we were on schedule.
It was 30 days in the law.
Was it 30 days? Or? But we would have issued an RFP.
Yes.
Issued. Advertised. Not so much awarded, but advertised.
That's right.
That's
what the law said.
Okay. I understand from my staff we made the schedule.
You don't know personally?
Well, I can verify that. I mean, we have the issue dates.
But you don't know personally, as you sit there.
Mr. Perez, can you please answer the question? And I ask that the parties not coach your witnesses. Please address Mr. Fellow's question.
Can I reference some documents to respond? Or just respond personally right now? I do not know the answer.
Well, that's up to your attorney to make the appropriate motion at this time. But if he's not, I ask you to answer Mr. Fellow's question based on your personal knowledge. Please proceed.
On my personal knowledge, I understand that we made the schedule.
So it's not your personal knowledge, but something that somebody else told you, and you don't know as you sit there.
I have not verified for myself, no.
Okay. Now, the letters that were issued to the parties with regard to the rankings, were dated in January of 2009, but were not actually sent to them until March of 2009. Is that correct?
I don't believe that to be so, but I can verify that.
And if it is so, why did it take 2 months or a month and a half to release the letters?
Okay, if I ask you again, because I'm not going to allow any party to coach witnesses, Mr. Perez, please respond.
Just for the record, Mr. Camacho, I'm not looking at them for advice. I'm just staring out, thinking. One more time, Mr. Conley.
If the documents were dated in January to Guam Community Improvement Foundation saying they were not the number one ranked party, why would it take until March to send that letter to them?
I actually, first of all, it should not. But the day that I signed these letters of intent to warrant, or notice of selections, notice of rankings, is the day that it should have been served. This is news to me if what you're saying is true, that it was served 2 months thereafter. I do not know that.
What I'm saying is the letter is dated January 12th, I believe, and you signed it on March 5th.
Oh. Next to my signature, there's a date.
Yes.
Yes. That happens a lot. I always date my signatures as of the date when I verify that everything is in order. So that may be a typo that needed to be corrected, but the date that's accompanying my signature is the official date of its release, of when it should have been served.
So even though the letter was actually, I believe, dated January 16, 2009 and signed by you on March 4th, 2009, Public Works took a month and a half to get that letter out to the parties.
That is possible, yes.
Now, there's no overcrowding at GW now because of double sessions, is there?
I can't verify as far as the enrollment at GW if it's overcrowding or not, but I do know that it's less than with the JFK students out of there.
My question to you was, there is no overcrowding at GW now because of double sessions.
There is no overcrowding at GW because of double sessions?
Yes.
Because of no more double sessions. That's right.
Okay. And the JFK students, to your understanding, are in a temporary facility.
That's correct.
And that temporary facility has a one-year term, but subject to further terms if the parties deem appropriate and necessary.
No, it's a one-year term. Period.
It's actually a 10-year term, isn't it?
It's a 1 year term.
Have you seen the...
Yeah, I've seen the lease, and it's proposed for 10 years, but the appropriations and authorization by the legislature and approved by the governor is for 1 year.
The appropriation?
Yes.
Okay. So the term exceeds 1 year, but the appropriation is only for 1 year.
No, the term and the appropriation is for 1 year.
May I approach the witness?
Could you please show Mr. Abrams the document prior to approaching?
And that's also our civil liability. But let me ask a question, if I may, Mr. Camacho. I was wondering about this because it's my first exposure to proceedings of the OPA. Are we following the court rules of evidence? In other words, do we offer exhibits for identification and go through that process here and then offer them for admission into evidence at the right time? Or are they deemed in the record because we submitted them and there's no further offer required?
Well, these are informal proceedings, but I take your exhibit list as proposed exhibits. Whether or not we take them into the record, we will do so upon formal motion, of course, by the parties. Okay, of course, the agency procurement record and the filings are part of the record.
Well, at this point, I don't believe Mr. Cunliffe has asked that his exhibit be admitted.
I don't think we're at that stage. I think the issue is a question and information that Mr. Cunliffe is trying to... do you have an objection to this? Please state it for the record.
Well, you know, the objection that I would like... First, let me say that I'd be glad to stipulate that the exhibit be admitted into evidence. And I think before Mr. Perez starts talking about this document and we hear about what it says, it shouldn't be with respect to a document not yet in evidence, but it should be with respect to an exhibit that has been admitted. Now, again, to expedite these proceedings, I'm offering to stipulate if Mr. Cunliffe wants it in the evidence, that it be admitted in the evidence.
Okay, Mr. Cunliffe, any response to that stipulation?
I was offered a stipulation
that exhibit A by my client, and I think Mr.
Avery said exhibit I. Exhibit I. By the management would be admitted.
Management? What? Which party now?
The Attorney General's Office is offering it.
Okay, so that's their exhibit I. And that is your Exhibit A, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so admitted, please proceed, Mr. Cunliffe.
Thank you. Now I approach the witness.
Yes, you may.
Mr. Perez, I'm going to show you what's now been an exhibit, admitted as an exhibit. Have you seen this lease document before?
No.
So when you testified that the lease was only for 1 year, what information did you have upon which you were testifying?
In dialoguing with my colleagues, the lease is subject to availability of funds. The lease is subject to appropriations.
My previous question to you, Mr. Perez, was that exact phrasing, and that was that the lease is longer than 1 year, but it's subject to the availability of funding or appropriation.
That's correct.
So you do acknowledge that the lease can continue merely by the legislature appropriating the funding?
Absolutely.
Okay. So it is not a one-year lease?
It is a one-year lease until a new law is created to appropriate funding.
I will reserve on that as semantical, Mr. Camacho, if I might. Okay. Let me ask you this, Mr. Perez. The Department of Public Works is responsible for the integrity of the structures of buildings in the territory of Guam.
That's correct.
And you testified during your direct examination that a task force from the Attorney General's office went out to JFK and declared it, I guess, unsafe. Is that
correct?
And it is my understanding that that facility was built in approximately 1958 or 1959, something like that?
Thereabouts.
Okay. And why is it that the Department of Public Works hadn't gone out on its own to make this determination sometime prior to the Attorney General having to do so?
There are a lot of requirements that are out there, and the government, the DPW, in decades past, have issued citations on legal non-conforming buildings. Case in point, most of these buildings were constructed before the creation of codes, building codes, and there was an unwritten adoption that the government, when it does its renovations, it will upgrade it. When it has the funding and it does its renovations, it will assure that these legal non-conforming buildings will be brought up to code and compliance, and thus become legal conforming. So DPW has, in many decades past, issued these notices. However, it has not been. It has not used its heavy hammer because of the government not having the wherewithal or the funding to bring these buildings into compliance.
But you say that it is now necessary for the Office of the Public Auditor to issue this substantial interest of the government to order that this project go forward to be completed in 9 months so that the adequate education statute passed by the legislature can be put in effect when prior to this time you did nothing to see that these children had an adequate education in a safe building.
As I may mention before, the DPW has issued these citations in many decades past. The adequate education bill only came into fruition, I would say, 5 or 6 years ago. Prior to that, DPW has been stepping up and issuing the citations.
And you indicated that they didn't use the heavy hand or heavy hammer because of the finances of the government.
Yes, and at this juncture, we have the financing authorized to do it.
So, in your eyes, as the Director of Public Works, the facility could be unsafe, but because we didn't have the money, you weren't going to see that it got fixed.
Let's further from the truth. We will continue to issue citations, and they will not be, unless they're funded and authorized, we cannot do anything else with it until we get authorization and funding.
Can't you stop people from inhabiting facilities that are unsafe?
That's occurring as we speak, and the especially since the adequate education bill has passed, with those standards now, DPW has a strengthened enforcement powers, and we'll be collaborating with the public Attorney General's office to take it to the next level. Yes.
Now, you've indicated that the proposed legislation was for the construction of a school within 9 months.
It's for the finance, design, build, maintain of a school within 9 months, yes.
Okay. And that was issued more than 9 months ago?
Within 9 months upon award of a contract.
Okay. So, if the contract isn't awarded for 3 years, and then it's awarded, they'll be in compliance with the legislative directive.
If you read the fine print of 29114, it clearly says you advertise it and you negotiate all the components and you establish a contract. And when you establish the contract, you will have it will be constructed within 9 months from the time the contract is awarded to completion. There are a lot of unsaid or silent components within that whole cradle to grave. It did not say in the event of a protest, this shall be the step you take. It did not say in the event of a force majeure that this is the step you take. It did not say any of that. There are the law is actually silent on a lot of these components, but it is our goal, it is our representation that DPW will exhaust every effort to go through the procurement process, and just the procurement process alone, there's a step-by-step process in terms of from the time you advertise, the pre-bid conferences, the addenda issued, to the actual selection. Rating, ranking, selection. So that process Public Law 29114 is silent on all those components. And those components can actually extend the period of when you will have, from the time you advertise to the time you award a contract. Then there's a 9 months, and if there's force majeure, any activity in there, therein, materials will come in. There's an opportunity to extend the contract even for extenuating circumstances. The law is silent on all those components, but as you well recognize, cradle to grave, we strive for 9 months, but sometimes it doesn't work that way.
Okay. So my question again to you is that based upon the legislation, if it takes 3 years to enter into the contract, and you enter the contract, then the contractor has 9 months to complete it, and you will be in compliance with the public law.
If we follow all the steps governed by law, then yes.
And as you've indicated, that although the statute indicates that the construction should be completed in 9 months, if it's not, there's not really any teeth to be a problem for the contractor. There's nothing in there that says that they're kicked off the job, or they pay a fine, or they pay a penalty, or anything like that.
Those are all part of our negotiations in terms of performance issues and metrics thereof, and that's outlined in the document, but I don't know if we can disclose that at this hearing.
But there's nothing in the law in that regard?
There's nothing in the law in terms of performance bonds and anything thereof, yes.
And as you've indicated, there are issues of force majeure and, for instance, the rain that we've been having of late might delay construction if it were ongoing at this point, and you would therefore perhaps negotiate with whoever the appropriate bidder was to say, okay, you can have 12 months.
Yeah, there's a potential to negotiate that, yes.
So as we sit here today, if you were to enter into the contract tomorrow, you couldn't say it would be finished in 9 months.
I couldn't say it could not be finished in 9 months either.
But you couldn't say it would be finished in 9 months.
Well, yes, I could say that. I could say it could be finished in 9 months based on the negotiations that we've had.
And as you sit here today, if you entered into the contract tomorrow, do you know it would be completed in 9 months?
Barring any unforeseen circumstance, it can be finished in 9 months.
So your answer is no, you cannot say that, because there might be an unforeseen circumstance.
Well, this last question I submitted is already
Mr. Fellows, you know, he's not answering the questions. He's throwing hypotheticals rather than answering the question. He says, well, barring any unforeseen circumstances, I can say it could be. And so my answer when my question then was, well, because you don't know if there'll be unforeseen circumstances, you can't say that it will be done in 9 months. Not argumentative.
I'll allow you to ask the question just one more time. Objection overruled. Please proceed, Mr. Cunliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Cunliffe. Because you don't know if there will be any unforeseen circumstances, we can't say whether the contract would be completed in 9 months. Isn't that a fair statement?
No, it isn't. The contract can be completed within 9 months based on the negotiations and agreements, representations made by the contractor. There are language and caveat put into these negotiations that are things like acts of God, that obviously for any activity, you know, it still can be finished in 9 months, presuming that you have a certain number of days of work, a certain number of work days, and certain amount of manpower available to this project. In fact, it could be completed sooner than 9 months.
And it could take 2 years.
Based on the negotiations we have to date, it can be completed in 9 months or less.
And it could take 2 years.
If the negotiations go that way, then absolutely.
Now, you've indicated also that you expect there would be an increase in construction costs.
Yes.
How much?
It's based on schedule of values. It's based on type of units. There's not a magical figure or percentage that I can assign to this, but we have information of like items that we can share with you.
Well, I mean, essentially, although the original statute required the purchase of the collateral equipment for the high school. The legislature subsequently required the contractor of the temporary school to buy that collateral equipment, so that's no longer necessary to purchase. Isn't that true?
I don't know that. I don't know that to be true.
You don't know that the legislature has directed the temporary JFK facility collateral equipment to go into the new school once it's completed?
No, I don't. I don't know.
Now, if the OPA were to grant the substantial interest, do you have any opinion as to what that cost might be should the court say, we're going to stop that proceeding and issue a restraining order?
I'm going to object. Number one, hypothetical. Number two, calling for a conjectural response. And number three, calling for a legal opinion from someone who's not a lawyer.
Mr. Cunliffe?
I didn't ask him for a legal opinion. I asked him about costs. The hypothetical question, this whole thing is hypothetical. Their whole issue on substantial interest is hypothetical. They're saying the prices may go up. They're saying this might be one of the costs. But under one of the guidelines that the federal courts have used is how to benefit in overruling the stay compared to the potential cost of the override, including the costs associated with the potential that the protest might prevail. There's going to be costs, again, if they put somebody in place and they start the project, and the court stops it and says the protest is going to go forward, and then somebody wins the protest, they got to start all over again. I'm just asking if he's aware of those costs.
Go ahead, Mr.
Can I respond?
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I just heard Mr. Cunliffe say that this whole thing is conjectural, but the witness has already testified that it's not conjectural that the cost of the building construction materials are going to go up. He has evidence of that. So it's not conjectural. But this last question calls for nothing but rank speculation and an area of expertise that this witness is not qualified to answer.
Mm-hmm. I will overrule the objection. I'm going to allow you to continue that line of questioning as it's relevant to determining costs in general. Please proceed.
Thank you, sir. The area of questioning, Mr. Perez, is that you're asking that the Office of the Public Auditor find a substantial interest so that you may proceed with the award of this contract. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And have you taken into consideration the cost that may occur should IBC begin the project, the protest be upheld, and IBC be removed from the project?
No, I've not.
Okay. And have you taken into consideration the cost that may be associated with the court proceedings in that regard?
No, I've not.
Okay. Now, you've indicated that you wish to go forward with the substantial interest, with the offeror who was ranked first in the opinion of the persons who did the ranking. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, have you taken into consideration what effect might be on the overall cost of the project should the ultimate result be that the calculations and determinations of the rankings was incorrect?
Just repeat the question. So,
have you taken into consideration the costs and effect should the result of the protest be that the rankings, that IBC was the number one ranked offeror, be incorrect?
No, it's not.
And in the questions put to you by Mr. Abrams, you indicated that if in your continued discussions and negotiations with IBC, if they weren't able to comply with everything and meet the needs of this project, that you would go to the number two award potential. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But again, if at the ultimate end of these proceedings, the protest determines that the rankings were incorrect, you wouldn't know who the number two party would be. Isn't that correct?
That's just too hypothetical. That's rank conjecture. If somebody were to tell them that the rankings were incorrect, that's no pleading and no application filed by Mr. Cummins or anyone else to disturb the order of priority of the bid selection. It's too far-fetched.
Mr. Cummins, in response?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Camacho. The issues that were raised in our appeal was that they did not take into consideration the appropriate criteria in making their rankings. That the financial aspect was supposed to be 70% of this project, and we've stated that they didn't comply with that proper ranking. And if the OPA's office or the court determines that their ranking system was inadequate in their, how they based their determinations, then they're going to be helter-skelter. And my question to him is, if, I mean, he's taken into consideration that he's coming here before this commission, or this board, saying, this is the ranking, and if IBC doesn't get it, then I'll go to GEFF, and if GEFF doesn't get it, then I'll go to GCIF. But the question was, well, what if the rankings are all apart? How can you go forward anywhere? That's the purpose of my question.
The rankings are what they are. There's no disturbing of the rankings. If he raises it in his appeal, then that's something he ought to talk about when we have the hearing on the appeal and having the pre-appeal hearing conference on the 30th. I think that's the right place to talk about that, not here.
Well, I'm going to allow the question just as it pertains to whether or not he considered those costs, but as for whether or not the actual rankings were compliant with Guam procurement law, I will sustain Mr. Abrams' objection on that point. Okay, overrule it on the others and ask you to limit your questions as to matters pertinent to whether or not substantial interest exists, and not necessarily to the issues that we must resolve in the formal hearing on the appeal.
Yes, and I didn't think I was asking him to say that the rankings were incorrect, but so if under the ranking system, did you take into consideration that if the ranking system is not correct, that the cost would be different to the government of Guam?
No, because without violating...
I'm not asking for numbers.
Because the ranking is very mathematical. There's a weighting system. There's a description of how many points and percentages to be given out. Yes, it was a 70-30 split, but within each of those, the 70, the financial component, there is a weighting scheme, and on the 30, for everything else, there's a weighting scheme. And it's all being reviewed by the written document and the presentation and the Q&A by all the firms between each entity and the selection committee members, which is all the stakeholders, the Guam Public School System, the GEDA, and the DPW. So through that entire deliberation, whatever numbers came out, we are so confident with their rating and ranking that it was never an issue, that we never even contemplated calculating costs if it was a wrong rating and ranking and selection process. So no, we did not do any calculation or what if it was wrong because we were confident it was right, it was done right.
I am